So we're going to begin in the Bible study going through the Gospels. And the Gospels, are foundational material for all of us. But in some parts of the world, the Gospels are controversial. You know, there aren't just four. There are all sorts of Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas and all of this stuff. So, if you remember back to... I forget the movie. Anyway, a movie that basically undermined the credibility of the scriptures and the book that it was based upon. You know, it says Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and talks about all these other gospels. Well, you know, when you go through and analyze that, that's all nonsense. But that's where our world is, and you have that kind of stuff that does come out, and unfortunately it is quite confusing. So we're going to talk about some basic things as far as the Gospels are concerned. So we're going to go through all four of the Gospels today. We'll see how that goes. But we're not going to be reading lots of scriptures. This is more of a background of the background of the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, as you begin, we're going to start with the first one that's mentioned in the New Testament. So the writer of that particular book is thought to be Matthew. So does anybody know what Matthew means? What that book means? His name means? It means the gift of God. And what was Matthew's job? What's that? He was a tax collector. There may be some irony there, but anyway, he was his name means the gift of God. He was a tax collector. Does somebody know the other word for that's used in the Bible for tax collectors? Publicans. Yes, the publicans. And what was Matthew? He was also known by another name. He was also known as Levi, and so in the book of Matthew he's referred to as Matthew, but in Mark and Luke he's referred to as Levi. So Matthew lived in Capernaum, which is on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and as a tax collector, that was a very lucrative spot to be collecting taxes, because a road, basically in their time, an interstate passed right through the town of Capernaum. And that road that passed through there was called the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea. And it was a road that went all the way over to Babylon, and it came all the way down through Capernaum to Egypt. So you had lots of trade going north and south through that particular area. And Matthew, sitting there as the tax collector, it was a lucrative spot. And he was able to serve as a tax collector because the Romans had named him to be tax collector in that area. It wasn't just a job that you started doing, hey, I'm going to be a tax collector. It was a job that you received the Romans would give it to you, and then they would expect you to return a certain portion of the take to them. So, anyway, you had this was a well-traveled route, and it was a route by which invaders would come into the land of Israel, and it was also a route where there was a great deal of trade. And if you look at the history of Israel, Israel prospered when they controlled the Via Maris. When they controlled the roads where trade traveled, they were very prosperous. And when they lost control of those trade routes, you find that Israel struggled. So where did Matthew write his book? The thought is that he most likely wrote it in the Holy Land. And as you look at the general trend of the book and the orientation from which it was written, it would lend itself to that. Who were the recipients of the book? Well, as you read through the book of Matthew, Many elements point to Matthew's gospel being written to a Jewish audience. It was written to a Jewish audience. And there are reasons why we would conclude that. Why would we conclude that he wrote it to a Jewish audience? One of the main reasons was that Matthew, in his book, is very concerned with the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. He has more quotations and allusions to the Old Testament than any of the other New Testament authors. So he quotes a lot from the Old Testament and brings it forward into the New, and seeks to explain what came from the Old Testament and how it relates to the New Testament, and most specifically to Jesus Christ. At the time when Matthew wrote, there was a great expectation of the Messiah, and Matthew traces Jesus' descent from Abraham, which is a very important part of Christ being the Messiah. As he speaks to his audience, he really doesn't get into the subject of Jewish customs. Well, why wouldn't he get into Jewish customs? Well, because he's writing to a Jewish audience, why does he have to explain it to them? So he doesn't get into that. But if you look at Mark gets into quite a few Jewish customs and explains them. So you can see that they were written to different audiences. Matthew uses Jewish terminology. For instance, he does not when Matthew refers to the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom, how does he differ from the other writers of the New Testament? How do they refer to the kingdom? Kingdom of God. But Matthew says the kingdom of heaven. And that was a common Jewish usage. They did not want to use God's name in an irreverent way, so they clearly referred to the kingdom of heaven as opposed to the kingdom of God. And one of the main emphases that Matthew has is Jesus' role as the son of David. He mentions that repeatedly in the first verse and in several other verses throughout the book. And his being a descendant of David is quite important. Quite important. And we'll look at some more of those things as we look at other aspects of the Gospels. And so as you think, well, Matthew was written to a Jewish audience, which that's you can find evidence for that. But was he just writing it to the Jews? Is there any evidence that he wasn't just writing to the Jews? If you look at the Christ birth, you have these individuals called the Magi that came to see the Christ child. Were they Jews or were they Gentiles? We don't know. In all likelihood, they may have even been Israelites, and they may have been Gentiles. But they came to worship the infant Jesus. And as you look at Christ talking about the preaching of the gospel in Matthew chapter 13, he calls the world the field. It is God's field. And so it's not just talking about Israel, but the world is God's field. So God is interested in all mankind. And when Christ gives the Great Commission, which is quoted in Matthew chapter 28, to whom is the truth of the gospel to go? To the Jews only, isn't it? Or maybe Israelites. No, he says, go into all the world, doesn't he? So God has always been interested in all the world. So as you look at these are just a few of the things that point to the fact that Matthew's gospel does have an interest in relating to the Jews, but it also looks beyond the Jews to the whole world. And God is interested in all men. So Matthew's main purpose is to prove to Jewish readers that Jesus is their Messiah. And he does this primarily by showing how Jesus in his life and ministry fulfilled the Old Testament scriptures. So they're looking for the Messiah. They're familiar with the Old Testament. So how are you going to prove it to them? You're going to have to show them Jesus fulfilled this and this and this. He fulfilled all of these things and is clearly the one sent by the Father to fulfill the role of Messiah. Matthew also emphasizes Jesus being a descendant of David as the Messiah was to be. And there's some interesting things in there that we'll look at as we look at some of the genealogies. So Matthew's gospel, as we should know or hopefully recognize, is woven around five great discourses. So Matthew, as he was writing this, as God inspired him to establish these five discourses which we've talked about. The first one was the Sermon on the Mount. Then you go to Matthew chapter 10, which talks about the commission to the 12 disciples. Then we went to the parables given in Matthew chapter 13. And then we talked about the necessity for humility and forgiveness in Matthew 18. And then we talked about Matthew 23 through 25. And we talked about the condemnation of the religious leadership and then the Olivet Prophecy, and we kind of bunched them all three together. There's a case that you could make that Matthew 23 is a separate discourse, and then you have the Olivet Prophecy, which is a discourse in itself in Matthew 24 and 25. And then we didn't look at it this way, but others do. They look at the Great Commission found in Matthew 28, to be another discourse. So there would be seven discourses depending on how you break it up. But he organized it that way because that's going to help people better understand the words of Christ and what Christ was emphasizing to his disciples. And he emphasized various things which we can all learn from, but it's a method of organization and something that's very that we clearly see in the Scriptures, because it tells us something begins at this point, and then there's a clear ending, and then there's narrative, and then you pick up again where Christ is expounding, and then there's a clear ending, and then there's other things going on, other narrative, and then another section picks up. So you can see that clearly in the book of Matthew. So we're done with Matthew. I told you we were going to go through all of them today. So anyway, now let's go to the book of Mark. So Mark is interesting. Does anybody know what? So we know the book is named titled Mark, but did he have a? Did Mark have another name?
John.
So he was called John Mark. You know, you find that in the book of Acts where he's called John Mark. And Mark is probably the person who's referred to in Mark chapter 14, verses 51 and 52, which talks about the young man that was there when Christ was being questioned. And they said, well, he was one of those Galileans that were with Christ. And so they try to grab him, and he just runs away and leaves his robe there with them. And I'm sure he would have been easy to track down right after that, but he, out of fear, ran away. And it's thought that John Mark was that particular individual that was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they sought to grab him as well. Mark was a close associate of Peter. He was a close associate with Peter, and it was through Peter that Mark gains certain insights that he reflects in his gospel. It seems that that the information that Mark has in his gospel did not come to Mark as a finished account of the life of Jesus, but was based upon the preaching of Peter, arranged and shaped by Mark. So Mark was associated with Peter. He heard Peter preach, and then he took the truths that Peter taught and arranged them into what we know as his gospel. Some refer to Mark as Peter's gospel or Peter's story. And the first mention of Mark is in connection with his mother. And so Mark's mother lived in the city of Jerusalem. And her house served as a meeting place for believers. So Mark lived in the city of Jerusalem with his mother. She had a house there, and we see various members of the church coming to her house at times. When Paul and Barnabas returned to Antioch from Jerusalem, after they came to Jerusalem, there was a famine. They were sent down with an offering and to help the people that were suffering from the famine, and they brought it down. And after completing their mission and they were getting ready to go back to Antioch, they took John Mark with them. So he returned with them to Antioch. And then from that point on, he accompanies Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey. So he goes along with them as helper. So he goes with them. They go to the island of Cyprus, and he makes the rounds with them all around the island at the different places where they taught. And then they went over to Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and they landed there and were beginning their preaching in that particular area. And then he accompanies them as far as a place called Perga. And then we don't know why he abandoned Paul and Barnabas, but he said, "I'm out," and returned to Jerusalem. And we don't know what the problem was, whether there was, it doesn't indicate any conflict, or he was sick, or maybe he was homesick. We just don't know what took place. But at least one, I'm sure both Paul and Barnabas were unhappy about that. Hey, here we are on this mission, and we're accomplishing that mission, and you signed on to help us, and then you're going to quit? So I'm sure they were unhappy with that. And we'll find out they were clearly, at least Paul clearly was unhappy with that, and Paul apparently had a long memory. So Paul didn't let it go, as we'll see. So we see that that Mark's abandoning them did impact Paul's working relationship down the road with Barnabas, because as time goes along, they were going to start on a second missionary journey. And at that point, Barnabas says, "Well, let's take Mark again." And Paul says, "Are you kidding? Do you remember that this guy abandoned us on the first journey? No way I'm taking that guy. He's unreliable. I'm not going to take him." And Barnabas said, "Well, let's give him another chance." Barnabas, being the son of encouragement, and Paul being more realistic, said, "Sorry, we're not going to go through this again." He didn't have any confidence that maybe John had matured, maybe John had recognized that was a mistake to abandon them. But anyway, Barnabas was willing to take him along, and Paul said, "No way," and he took Silas with him on the second journey. And unfortunately, it caused Barnabas and Paul to no longer be able to work together. Doesn't mean that they never worked together, but it created a rift between them for a time. And it was a pretty, you know, you see them all as meek and mild and gentle. No, they had their opinions and their view of how things should go. Paul had his opinion, and so did Barnabas. And it caused them to separate. Now, ultimately, there was good that came from it. Because Barnabas went his way and Paul went his way, they actually covered more territory. So something that would seem to be sour, God actually made lemonade from it, and more people were exposed to the gospel as two men were on the job as opposed to one. As time went on, Mark appears in Paul's letters to the Colossians written from Rome. Paul sends a greeting from Mark and adds, "You've received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him." So Paul was not permanently against Mark. Paul was not, Paul had obviously recognized that Mark had matured and Mark was somebody that was reliable. So Mark had worked his way back into Paul's confidence. And let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, in regard to Mark. Excuse me, not verse 1, but verse 11. Paul says, "Only Luke is with me." So Luke, his name will come up here. Remember that in a little bit. He says, "Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me in my ministry." Get Mark and bring him to me, He's useful to me in my ministry. So that's quite a change from being unwilling to rely on Mark at all. And it shows that sometimes people are immature and do make bad choices, but time goes on and they mature and they can be an asset, and we need to have that perspective. Where did Mark write his gospel from? It seems that it was most probably written from Rome. And so the Roman church was who it was directed to. The evidence that it was the church at Rome, or at least to Gentile readers, we find some evidence for that in the book itself, because Mark has to explain Jewish customs. If he was writing to a Jewish audience, he wouldn't have to explain it. For instance, he has to explain in Mark chapter 7 about the washings and things that were done. Jews would have understood that, wouldn't they? He wouldn't have had to explain it. But he explains it because his audience was primarily Gentile. He also has to translate Aramaic words in various places because Romans and Gentiles wouldn't understand that. And he seems to have a special interest in persecution and martyrdom, because you find that in several places in the Scriptures. Let's just look at one. Let's go to Mark chapter 8. And as you look at the four Gospels, you see different emphasis. You know, they don't emphasize the same thing. Mark chapter 8, let's look at verse 34. It says, "And behold," yes, Matthew 8, verse 34, it says, "When he had called the disciples to himself and his disciples also, he said to them, 'Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?'" So he talks about being ashamed of him, and talks about persecution. And he not only talks about it in Mark 8, but he also does so in other portions of the Scriptures. And, you know, the Roman members of the church were persecuted, so this would be something that would be on their mind. Also, he includes several Latin phrases that would have meant nothing to Jewish readers, but those who had a Roman background and a Latin background would definitely understand it. So, things that he emphasizes in his gospel. First of all, he emphasized that Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God. And he emphasizes the humanity of Jesus, but also emphasizes that he is God's Son. And one of the ways he does this is in emphasizing miracles. You find in the book of Mark 18 miracles that take place. That's quite a few miracles that he emphasizes in his book. And the reason is to point out that he was God in the flesh. He was the Son of God. He emphasizes the death of Jesus. He points out that the Jewish leadership conspired to kill Jesus, but that also this was a divine necessity, because he had to die, the Messiah had to die for the sins of mankind. And Jesus fulfilled that responsibility, dying for all of us so that our sins could be forgiven. It's interesting, I think, as we get closer to the Passover than as we do Bible study, I'm going to have some questions for you that just read, you know, you read scholarly things about the death of Christ and your mind is just overwhelmed by how amazing their conclusions are, which they're not even on the same page as we are in understanding of the Scriptures. They just see it completely differently. And they do not believe that, you know, they look at Mark and things he brings out and the miracles and all that. They just don't believe that at all. And that the Jewish leadership conspired against Christ, they don't accept that at all. So you're like, well, are they reading the same book that I am? They are, but their interpretation is much different. So I'll let you see what they say, and we'll see how you refute it. How would you deal with somebody that brought this up? We have the Mark emphasizes the teachings of Jesus, although Mark records far fewer actual teachings of Jesus than the other gospel writers. There's a strong emphasis on Jesus as a teacher. If you look through the book, you'll find that the words teacher, teach, teaching, and rabbi are applied to Jesus 39 times. So that's a lot of references to Christ as a teacher. So he's pointing that out, that Christ came and he taught. Discipleship, he talks a great deal about what it means to be a disciple and follower of Jesus Christ. So those are all things that he emphasizes in his gospel. So Mark's gospel, interestingly, also emphasizes action. It emphasizes action. Mark is simple, but a vivid account of Jesus' ministry, emphasizing more what Jesus did than what he said. Now, why might he have that emphasis? Think about from whom did Mark get a lot of what he put into his gospel? Wasn't it Peter? Was Peter a man of action? Absolutely. You know, Peter, don't just wash my feet, wash my whole body. When Christ is coming, walking on the sea, the stormy sea, what does he do? Jumps out of the boat. So he was a man of action. That's always the way he was. He's the guy that had the sword, and he's the one that hacked off the high priest's servant's ear. So, whack. That's not what Jesus wanted, but that's what he did. So he was a man of action, and he always was a man of action. So Paul emphasizes that it could very well be a matter of his association with Peter. Now, what would be a second reason for the way the book is written, where it puts an emphasis on action? Consider the Romans. The Romans themselves were people of action. One thing that the Roman world would really appreciate was people who got things done. They were men of action. Look at the Romans and what they did. Some of what they did is still around today. You know, they were great road builders all over North Africa, Europe, and all of the places, you know, on into England. You have their roads there. You also have their cities. You have their walls. You have their bridges. Like somebody said, some of their bridges are still standing, and we don't make bridges as good as they do. You know, they had something going there. I'm not sure they could take high-speed, cars traveling over them with great speed, but they certainly handled a lot for a lot of years. And they were quite good at building bridges, and they built empires. So Mark seems to include that in his gospel because the Romans could identify with that. And he's trying to reach people with the gospel of Jesus Christ, to share with them the truths about our Savior. The third writer of the Gospels is Luke. The author of the Gospel is a companion to another volume that we find in the Bible. What is the companion book in the Bible to Luke? The book of Acts. So the book of Acts was written by Luke also. And the language and structure of the two books indicates they were written by the same person. And they are addressed to the same individual, Theophilus. And the second volume, the book of Acts, refers to the first. So the person who was Luke's patron, his name was Theophilus. So what does Theophilus mean? Lover of God. Someone who loves God. And it's interesting, as you look through the book of Acts, there comes a point in the book of Acts where you find a pronoun, we. And And at that point, it appears that Luke had begun to travel with the Apostle Paul. And if you go through there, you'll reach a point where it says we. And it's just not a great detail, but it is something that we can see. So he was traveling with Paul at a certain point. And by process of elimination, Paul's dear friend, Luke the doctor, as he's called in Colossians 4, verse 14, and fellow worker, as he's called in Philemon 24, becomes the most likely candidate for writing that particular book. Luke was a Gentile by birth. He was well educated in Greek culture. He was a physician by profession. And he had an outstanding command of the Greek language. And he began to accompany Paul on his second missionary journey and continued with him until he was in Rome during Paul's imprisonment. He was a loyal friend, and he remained faithful to Paul through to the end. When others had abandoned him, which we saw in 2 Timothy, Luke was still with him. And notice he says, bring Mark with you. So Mark was still faithful and loyal, and I'm sure came to him. Because Paul went largely to the Greek world, that is what Luke's gospel seems to be oriented to. His gospel is historical and it's detailed. And interestingly, as you look at the book of Luke, there are many things that you can see in it, both in Luke and Acts, that you can find historically. You can find archaeological information about it. And Luke, being a Greek, was trained probably in logical presentation of things. And so Luke, in his gospel and in the book of Acts, presents things in a logical pattern. And as you go through the Gospel of Luke, and you also go through and look at the book of Acts, you can find things archaeologically. I remember as we were doing Bible studies on Paul's journeys, and in the city of Ephesus, they had this thing called a bama, which is this raised pedestal, and they would get up on that and they would speak. And so you remember when Paul has gotten them all upset about, they stop worshiping Diana of the Ephesians and they're standing out there in the streets screaming for who knows how long, great is Diana of the Ephesians. I can't imagine standing out there for any amount of time yelling that, but that was the mindset at that particular time. And they brought Paul and Silas to be tried, and they brought them there to this bama, and the people are gathered there, and the Asiarchs are telling them, look, you guys are getting out of hand, and if we don't calm this down, this is going to go badly because the Romans don't like this. And the Romans tend to come in and start killing people if they don't like it. So why don't we knock it off? So and then they throw Paul and Silas in the slammer and all of that. But I don't think they did then. That was later. I think that was in Philippi. So anyway, they're gathered there, and this is still in the city of Ephesus. So if you take that journey, you can see that archaeological relic. So the gospel, who are the recipients and the purpose for Luke's gospel? The gospel is specifically directed, as I said, to Theophilus, and who was the one he wrote the gospel to and the book of Acts. And the use of the term most excellent indicates that he was an individual who was important, an individual who may have even been a Roman official. We don't know exactly, but he was at least of high position and wealth. He very well may have been Luke's patron. He was the one who was responsible for seeing that the writings were copied and distributed. And the book was dedicated to the patron. And Theophilus helped to promote the book and to make sure the book was copied and spread around. As you look at Luke and what he wrote, Luke was not an eyewitness. Matthew it appears was an eyewitness. If it's, you know, one of the disciples, obviously he was. Mark was an eyewitness because he was there in the Garden of Gethsemane when they tore away his cloak. But Luke was not an eyewitness. He comes on the scene later. So what's he doing writing a gospel? Because aren't they to be witnesses to what's taken place? Well, what Luke did was he spoke to those who were eyewitnesses. He wasn't himself, but he spoke to those who were eyewitnesses. And he spent a lot of time with the Apostle Paul, so obviously he was one of the sources. And Luke begins his gospel this way. He says, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us." So what he did is he went out and he interviewed those who were eyewitnesses. And he got the details about what they saw and recorded it for all of us. And then as he goes on in verses, he says that it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all these things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed. So I've talked to the witnesses, and I've written down what they've relayed so that you can have confidence in what we've seen and what we believe. So he's seeking to establish that what he's relaying to him is accurate, and we can have, and they can have certainty in it. Again, he most probably wrote the gospel from Rome, and by its details, designations of places in the Holy Land, the gospel seems to be intended for readers who were unfamiliar with the area of Judea. Some key points. Luke's gospel presents the works and teachings of Jesus that are especially important for understanding the way of salvation. And interestingly, he covers the entire story of Jesus Christ from his birth to his ascension to heaven. And in the book of Acts, he carries on the story with the church and the apostles. And it's interesting how he ends the story. There's not a clear-cut ending, is there? Indicating that the church and what God is working out is going to continue on beyond this particular book. I wish we had more, but he stops at a certain point and that's it. His writing appeals to both Jews and Gentiles, and it's characterized by literary excellence, historical detail, and a warm and sensitive understanding of Jesus and those around him. He appears to have a tender heart, because as you look through the book, you'll find that he places an emphasis on women, on children, the family, and the poor, and as he lays out his stories and his parables. He thought highly of and brings in women and children, the family, and the poor. And he recognizes the place of Gentiles as well as the Jews in God's plan. So his sources, Luke tells us that many others had written of Jesus' life, but he went beyond this for his own writing. And he wrote based on testimony from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, as he tells us in chapter 1, verse 2. And so, you know, he sought to get eyewitnesses and record those things for us. So Luke basically covers Jesus' ministry in a geographical manner. He begins by talking about his Christ ministry in the area of Galilee. He does that from chapter 4, verse 14 to chapter 9, verse 50. And then he speaks about Christ's ministry in Judea and Perea. Does anybody know where Perea is? Perea is the area just north of the Dead Sea. That area that would be Moab, where Israel came into the land after they had been 40 years in the wilderness. They crossed there at Jericho. Perea is there across there and around the northern part of the Dead Sea. And so Judea would be on the western side, Perea on the eastern side. And then he speaks about the final week in Jerusalem from chapter 19, verse 28 to chapter 24, verse 53. And what is the main theme? It's found in Luke chapter 19, verse 10. The main theme is the nature of Jesus' messiahship and mission. And chapter 19, verse 10 says, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." Chapter 19, verse 10, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." One final book, John. The author of the book is the Apostle John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And John is the brother of another apostle by the name of James. And John and James were both sons of a man by the name of Zebedee. And the Bible also talks about John being the apostle of love. So was John always the apostle of love? He was not. You remember when they were disrespected in one place. And so what did John and James want to do? Bring down fire from heaven on these people. Just blot them out. And Christ said, "Relax, boys, we're not going to do that." You know, but that's where they were at that particular point. But as you go through and you look at the gospel and you look at John's epistles, you see a very different person. A person who grew and matured in the faith and was able to expound on love, the love of God. And he became a very loving person. He was clearly changed by God's Spirit. And he became a good example of a man who is deeply converted. So as you look at John, he grew greatly in God's way of life. He clearly had a love of Christ, so much so that Jesus, when he was dying, said, "John, this is now your mother. Please take care of my mom." So he entrusted his mother to John, and John apparently took care of Mary for the rest of her life. How many of you knew that Jesus and John were cousins? So anyway, that Jesus and John were cousins. And the reason we know that is that Mary and a lady by the name of Salome were cousins. John and James were the sons of Salome, and Salome was Mary's sister. And you can find that in as you look through the scriptures, and if you read through the booklet Jesus Christ, the Real Story, it'll explain that more fully. But they were cousins. And interesting. So John was quite familiar with Jewish life, and we see this from his references to popular messianic speculations, to the hostility between the Jews and Samaritans, to Jewish customs, such as the duty of circumcision on the eighth day, taking precedence over the Sabbath prohibitions. Also, he knew the geography of the Holy Land. For instance, he mentions the town of Bethany being 2 miles from Jerusalem. So he was familiar with that. And also he was familiar with the town of Cana, which we don't find mentioned in any of the other scriptures. So he was familiar with that and where Christ went in order to make water to wine. The Gospel of John has many touches that appear to reflect the recollections of an eyewitness, such as the house of Bethany. And how do you know John was at the house in Bethany? He records something that you wouldn't know unless you were there. Remember, Christ was there, and this woman came with the bottle of spikenard, I believe it was, and poured it out on Jesus' feet and washed his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of that particular perfume. And John remembered it and recorded it for us. So he had to be there. And he saw it. And Most believe John's gospel was written much later than the other gospels. So the other three gospels were written earlier. John's is written later to supplement the accounts found in the other gospels. Some also believe that the more developed theology of the fourth gospel and its counter-arguments to Gnosticism indicate that it was written later. It's also thought that John wrote independently of the other gospels, and thus it was, we don't see them correlating with the other gospels. It's just completely different. If you were to use a technical term for Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're a particular type of gospels. Does anybody know that technical term? They're synoptic, and it means the same view. Optic means view. Syn means the same or together. So they see things from a similar perspective is what is the reason they call them that. And they cover many of the same topics from different perspectives, and they add different elements that help to fill out the whole picture of Jesus Christ. But John is totally different, and he gives us a view of Christ that is quite different from the others. He highlights matters that the other Gospels don't, and there's very little overlap between what John covers and what we find in the Synoptic Gospels. The literary style of this Gospel is also unique. We don't find any parables in John's Gospel. His focus is on the signs of Jesus, his identity and mission, and on deep, detailed theological discussions. You can't find, if you go back and you look at, the scriptures that we read after the Passover, as you stop and think about all the things he's saying there, they're fairly involved theological discussions. John 17, he's going to come and make his home with all of us, and we're all going to be one and all of that. That's fairly involved. You got to stop and think about it and consider what he says. It's just not something that we understand fully without giving it some thought. John states his main purpose clearly in John chapter 20, verse 31. He says, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He wants people to believe that Jesus Christ is the Christ and the Son of God, and that you may have life. And he's speaking of eternal life there in his name. And it's thought that one of the main things that John is combating in his gospel is Gnosticism. Gnosticism taught that anything that was physical was created by an evil power, and anything that is spiritual was created by God. And the spiritual is good, and the fleshly is bad. That's the basics of Gnosticism. So John emphasizes what? He emphasizes that Jesus was God who came in the flesh. Isn't that, boom, right out of the chute, he lays that out there in John 1, chapter 1. He very clearly tells you that. And that's something that the Gnostics would deny, that Jesus was physical. And John spends a lot of time countering that in his gospel and also in his letters. And this is a primary reason many date John's gospel to the 90s AD, because by this time the adversaries had developed and they had a particular point of view, and he's refuting that. And one of the things that's interesting with John is he tells you very clearly that Jesus was flesh, and he also tells you we were with him and we touched him, we saw him, and he was a flesh and blood human being. One theory found in Gnosticism is that he wasn't real. He was a phantom. So he went along, and then when he was put on the cross, then he just left, and the flesh and blood suffered, but the spirit left. That's just nonsense. But anyway, that's people believed that at that particular time. So John talks a lot about Jesus' humanity. And in order to bring out that he was flesh and blood, he talks about Jesus getting tired. He was human. And John was an eyewitness to all of this. Jesus got thirsty. Jesus became troubled. And Jesus truly loved people. And all of these things were diametrically the opposite of what the Gnostics taught. So that's a brief background of the Gospels. And so next month we will pick up and we'll be talking about the dating of the Gospels, and we'll also be looking at some of their differences and bring out some other aspects of this particular topic. So I hope you found it profitable. Please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath day. Thank you for your attention, and we'll see you all next week.